Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Ksenia Chemutina, senior lecturer at Loughborough University, will join us to discuss the historical context behind Joe Biden's Build Back Better slogan, specifically its roots in neoliberalism.
And Heather Digby-Parton will join us to discuss the biggest news stories of the week. Come a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It's your support that helps this show keep going. And don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/Sam Cedar. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby-Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, another week. We are in an interesting week. There's a lot of things that are being teed up this week. We saw this week basically where the Democrats made the commitment to go forward with what is known as reconciliation. We can talk a little bit about what that is, but that involves a certain number of preliminary votes in the House and the Senate. Those votes have been taken. They have passed. Democrats are going forward with this. Even though the week started off with 10 Republicans showing up to Joe Biden with their proposal, air quotes, to COVID relief. And Joe Biden welcomed them into the White House, had a conversation with them. We can talk about that. And of course, impeachment is coming up next week. And some of what we saw this week with Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think, and AOC, frankly, obviously is going to implicate those impeachment hearings. But let's stay with the relief for the time being. Why don't you just lay out for us where we're at and what you think is going on here? I'm curious as to your perspective on the way that Biden handled this proposal from 10 Republican senators. And we should say 10 is relevant because I think you made this point last week. You can have a gang of 16, 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats. But if you don't get 10 Republicans to vote for something, you might as well have no Republicans voting for it, because 8 Republicans voting for something is just not going to get it to pass because of the filibuster. And then you might as well just go to reconciliation, and those Republicans can vote for it or not if they want to.
Well, that's absolutely right. It's, you know, the number 10 was significant. And of course, you know, I get nervous whenever I see anything like that. I'm sure you do, too. Any of us who've been through these, you know, negotiations in the past, and, you know, most especially in negotiations in the midst of an emergency like we did back in 2009, which Biden participated in, we get nervous because suddenly everything looks like, okay, you know, they're going to give away the store, or there's going to be massive delays, and there's going to, you know, all the motivation and the energy that you need to get something like this done suddenly dissipates, and, you know, you find yourself with the Democrats holding the bag and the people not getting the relief that they need, the worst of all possible worlds. So I was nervous about it. But, you know, I think we discussed last week the idea that, you know, Biden's just come into office after a very rocky transition. I mean, it was not one where he could just smoothly, you know, come into office and start doing things because they had been well prepared over the previous couple of months. It wasn't like that. And you have this uproar in the Congress, and you've got the impeachment, and there's all this other stuff going on. So it's a tough start for any presidency. And we discussed the idea that maybe they were just kind of vamping a little bit, trying to get their bearings before they really, you know, dug in and decided which way to go. And I think that Biden's, you know, his instinct is to be courteous to the other side. He's not one, I don't think, unless back to the wall, that he's going to, you know, start screaming in Republicans' faces right off the bat. It's just, it's not, we're sort of used to that with Trump. That was kind of his deal. He said he would come into meetings and everybody would be sitting there, and then he'd just look in the face of the top negotiator and, you know, say, F you, and then walk out of the room. And that's how he did negotiations. Well, you know, that's not Biden's style. So,
right.
So the inviting of the Republicans up there, while it made me nervous, I tried to keep an open mind. And I think he did okay with that. I mean, it sounds like they chatted and chatted. He may have worn them out with all the polite discussion. But it was also true that at that very same moment, they were working on starting the machinery to get reconciliation going. They've made it very clear now this week that they're not going to, you know, I mean, there may be some little fiddling around the edges, but not enough to keep those 10 Republicans on board. I mean, you have some real right-wingers among those 10, because there has to be, because the caucus doesn't have 10 moderates who are willing to work with Republicans.
Right.
So they had to pull in some people at least for, you know, for the purpose, I think, of probably tanking any kind of agreement. They're feeling out Biden to see if he'd bite. And then what they always do, it's the Lucy and the football metaphor, right, where they come up with, they do a whole bunch of agreements to lower the bill in some way that the Republicans want, and then at the last minute say, well, we can't really vote for it anyway. So this, you know, I think that, you know, Biden did the right thing, but at the same time, it seems as though anyway, at least as we sit here today, this week, that they've got reconciliation. The machinery is going now. They've actually said it, and Biden came out and said, look, you know, that's nice. I'm glad to talk to him, glad to hear from him. But, you know, we really have a big problem here that we have to solve, and we're not going to budge. So maybe Joe Manchin can get him to, you know, bite around the edges of some of the proposals. But essentially, even Manchin has said, well, the number is the number. I think the $1.9 billion, you know, that sounds right to him. And I haven't heard anybody else come up and start arguing about the details, which sort of indicates that they don't have a bunch of divas who've decided that this is their moment to shine and go on TV and pretend like they're going to tank the bill if they don't get what they want. So I'm mildly and,
cautiously,
slightly optimistic at this point that they're going to get this bill passed. And we can talk more about the details of some of the things that maybe are a problem and, you know, whether or not that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment. I would say, I had the exact same reaction you did when I woke up Monday morning and read that Biden was inviting him to the White House. I'm like, oh, God, here it comes. But I will say this, that I listen to radio in the mornings and often music these days. But they'll do at the top of the hour the minute long AP briefing or whatever it is. And the way it's been reported there, I find to be very encouraging, because it's basically, look, they can't get into the details. It's just the Republicans want there to be less relief for COVID. And like, it's, you know, that's, I mean, that there are, I cannot remember, right? Because like, none of this, the question isn't, is this discretionary, right? I mean, it is technically, but I mean, all of it's discretionary, but there's such an urgency and such a need and such a universal, you know, we're all in a pandemic, and to be clear, it is definitely hurting some people more than others, but there is a baseline. We are all involved in a pandemic, which, relatively speaking, in terms of our society, there's not many events that we can say that, right? You know, 9/11, everybody's, it impacted, but it wasn't necessarily a material impact. But this, we're in something now where everybody is experiencing this. There is no argument as to the need. And I just think that, like, when the argument is presented less or more help, that's it. If you're on the side of more help as a political matter, I would also argue as a policy matter, but as a political matter, you won, right? Like, I mean, and if the only story that came out of that was Republicans are going to ask Joe Biden to do less to help the American public, I'll take that. And I think that's going to help. And you're absolutely right. I don't think it was just for them about testing Joe Biden's resolve. I think it was about testing Joe Manchin's resolve or Kristen Sinema's resolve. I think they thought, like, well, if we present this this notion that there was a deal to be had with Republicans. Is that going to make Joe Manchin feel nervous because that, you know, he needs to maintain his brand? And this is the thing I think that people don't fully understand about someone like Joe Manchin or Susan Collins. It's not any particular vote that they take. It is really more just how it impacts their broader brand. And so nobody's going to necessarily question them on a specific vote, but they just need to always present themselves as being somewhat reluctant and crossing this threshold. And I'm not a party guy. I'm not a partisan person. I'm a maverick, or however they want to, I'm of the party of common sense, or whatever the hoo-ha that they're dishing. And, and it didn't move Joe Manchin. I imagine part of it was just like, I have an argument to give the American public less. I think that's just not going to play in this context. B, Kamala Harris went down to West Virginia, gave an interview, which apparently ticked Joe Manchin off, but he had to back off it because the Republican governor, former Democrat of West Virginia, came out and said, like, we need this money. We don't want to dilly dally. And I think that left Joe Manchin with like, oh, OK, I can't let this Republican get to the left of me on this. And so those factors all have contributed to this. And like you say, Joe Manchin was on, Scarborough and said, you know, screw it. If it's got to be 1.9, it's got to be 1.9. I mean, I don't know why everybody at that point just doesn't take the win and walk away. You know, everybody's trying to score some political points of like, well, I think I still have, a couple of brand opportunities by talking about maybe we should be slow down on this. But Ryan Grimm has a story in The Intercept. I think I mentioned that, like, 2000, that the lesson of 2009 has been learned by some of these. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that from a policy standpoint, but from a political standpoint, they understand there's no point in messing around. You got to get this done.
Absolutely. I read that article too, and I think you and I had actually talked about this, the how in the past that they're always fighting the last war, and how in the past when they in 2009 they'd still been worried about the Reagan era, flogging of deficits and all the rest of this, even as they rose deficits, and how they were so concerned about, spending too much money. They even pegged, I think it was Susan Collins who was one of the ones who insisted on it, that it had to be $900 billion for the stimulus, because they couldn't go over a billion, beyond that it would be, if you went up too high, it was going to really, make them all nervous, et cetera, et cetera. And then they ended up, getting two votes or something. I can't remember which two they were in the Republicans. So they learned that this, kind of worrying about the number, and they've been very good about this, I think, because I've been listening to the press secretary too. She, when they ask her about it over and over again, are you willing to come down in the number? And she reframes it instantly by saying, well, what is it you think they should cut? Because we didn't put this together based on the number. We put this policy together based upon the actual needs that we, recognized were needed. And so, where do you think they should cut? What should they cut out? Money for schools, money for states and cities, money, like that. So instead of getting hooked on the number as being meaningful in and of itself, they've been refocusing it back on the policy. And that was one lesson that they learned, because once you get into that numbers game, then, it's just they whittle it away, one by $1 after another dollar, and you're pretty soon you've lost the argument. I think they've handled this stuff maybe better than I expected. I mean, I don't actually know. I guess I have my vision of who Joe Biden is, and maybe he's more agile than I thought he was, just considering that he's been around a long time, and I thought I sort of had an idea. So I'm a little bit optimistic here that they're going to be able to do this, and that is the fact. If they can get this out the door quickly, this big package with the kind of direct relief, which now we're starting to see other people come up with the ideas of direct direct relief and starting to talk about, you know, doing some of these big ideas, economic ideas, even coming a little bit from the Republicans. Mitt Romney, he doesn't really count as a Republican. I don't know what his brand is, his own brand, but whatever. You know, you're starting to see some, you know, some thoughts here that maybe, you know, some big stuff is going to happen. And I'm not sure I ever really believed it would under these circumstances. But with the Republicans being, to coin a phrase, in disarray, you know, and the Democrats having this bare majority and willing to actually push hard, who knows? I mean, maybe this will be one of those times. It's hard to imagine because all the times when really big legislation has taken place, they've had big majorities, and we don't have that. But on the other hand, you know, these Republicans are living on an alternate planet at the moment, so maybe they're not the impediment that they normally would be. I mean, I'm starting to think that maybe they're so, you know, completely obsessed with their Trumpian vision, which is nothing to do with legislation, that maybe, you know, maybe they're just going to play their own game on Fox and Newsmax and OAN while the Democrats actually govern. I mean, it's possible.
I want to circle back to that because I think that's actually like a fascinating thing that seems to be happening on or a fascinating thing that could be happening. But I want to stay on that number thing because for a moment, the point you were making about that, because, you know, as you're talking about it, your assessment and the recounting of what happened in 2009 is absolutely correct. But I do think that we need to take a moment to just sort of try and absorb how absolutely bat crap crazy it is that they are determining these massive questions. And I think there is I don't think it's a controversial statement at all at this point, regardless of whose circles you walk in, that the 2009 stimulus was anemic, was just not enough, was not up to the task. I mean, I don't think anybody disputes that. There was a trajectory coming out of the Obama years of the economy that was fine, but it was happening way, 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 way too slowly. And so much so that we saw the political fallout from it, I think.
Absolutely.
But when you think that the reason why that decision was made was not based on economics, but rather just literally like a guy who is, you know, owns an appliance shop and he's deciding between a markup of 75% or, you know, 85% on the vacuum cleaner that he's selling. He's just like, well, $49.99 sounds better than $54. You know, like just the idea that it's just the number, not associated at all with the policy, is just, it is so hard to sort of wrap your head around when you think about the implications of that in terms of like the immiseration of literally millions of people, foreclosures and unemployment and, you know, careers set back for years and pension funds not being funded. And I mean, and the idea that the Democrats have learned, I mean, you know, and of course, that's what $1.9 trillion is about, right? I mean, there's a ton of things that you could pour into a bill like this that could be needed. Now, there is, of course, some constraints, and we should talk about those in a moment in terms of reconciliation, because there's statutory obligations to have, over a course of a 10-year horizon, the finances of the government to be basically net zero, which may bring about a certain amount of cuts to Medicare. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the idea that these sort of random numbers just dictate what our policy are going to be, and that there seems to be a little bit more savvy amongst the Democrats, not so much. I think, you know, Republicans may actually have more savvy to this, that the American public, it's just a number. like, there's no difference between 3 trillion and 2 trillion in terms of the American public's mind, because, of course, nobody can conceive of such numbers anyways. It's just, I don't know. Does 3 trillion sound more than 2 trillion? It sounds like 1 trillion more, I guess. But I mean, if I was to say, well, we're going to do a platillion, and just made it up. Well, that's my shorthand for 4 trillion. It's quite possible that people would say, like, well, I guess I'd feel more comfortable doing a platillion than 2 trillion. Like, it's just a number. It's just a name. It's just like a, you know, word. Like, nobody's sitting there going, like, well, if we do 3 trillion instead of 2 trillion, then we're going to get overheated in the blankety blank sector. Like, that's just, no one's got that argument. And the idea that we can do too much, I think people are starting to realize, like, well, no, we really can't. And to the extent that we ever found ourselves in that situation, we have all of the faculties we need to, you know, cool things down if that was really a problem.
Exactly. And it's interesting because there are two prongs to their, you know, argument about the number, right? I mean, one is allegedly an economic argument that, you know, if you get the debt goes too high and then interest rates go soaring and then we have, you know, inflation and it's going to be awful, just like it was in 1979, and we can't ever do that. Thank God Reagan came in and saved us. That's been the right wing, you know, deficit, you know, mongering for the last, you know, 40 years. That's just what they have always said. And the Democrats rode along with that. I mean, I guess they got beaten over the head with it so often. And, you know, time after time would come into office after the Republicans had run up this deficit, and then they would be very good little soldiers and do something to bring the deficit down, or they would, you know, restrict, like, the $900 billion in the stimulus bill. You know, we don't want to get the deficit people all upset. And you remember in 2009, the deficit was a gigantic issue. I mean, it was everywhere. It colored everything that they talked about in this. At some point or another, the Democrats have, you know, somehow it's penetrated them that their argument is nonsense, and that doesn't necessarily happen. Year after year, as the deficit rises, it becomes clear that they have tools that they use, and they are using now. I mean, it doesn't mean it will never happen, but let's just say it hasn't been imminent for 40 years that the deficit rising in an emergency causes all this horrible fallout that you can never get out of. I mean, this is just, you know, basic Keynesian economics that they've been fighting against. So there's that economic argument, and then there's the political argument, which is somehow that Americans really care about the debt in some specific way. You know, they always put it in terms of, you know, well, if you let your household get too much in debt, and then you can't pay it back, and then you lose your house and car, or something like that. And, you know, that has also not happened. So the salience of this particular approach to trying to starve the government, which is essentially, you know, that's the Grover Norquist project, that's the right-wing project, you know, it's a sort of a libertarian, you know, economic sort of Republican conservative kind of ideology, which is that, you know, you cannot let the government do too much, you know, and big government bad, small government good, and all this. That whole thing has been, you know, discredited, or at the very least has just become something kind of, I don't know, it sounds old-fashioned to me at the moment. Yeah. You know, it's like one of those things where you kind of hear it and it sounds like, you know, from when you were a kid or something.
Right.
So I suspect that it's just been, I mean, we have had one crisis after another for the past 20 years, starting with 9/11, rolling into the 2008 financial crisis, rolling into, well, Trump in general, and then, of course, the pandemic and all this. And every single time, you know, when the government does step up to actually, you know, do things, and, you know, I would argue that 9/11, the approach to that was wrong, if particularly with respect to Iraq. But nonetheless, this idea that the government has a role to play in these situations, you know, that their argument about small government and all of that has just kind of lost its, I don't know, its impact, I guess. So on a political level, I think what you're seeing, you know, here you got good old Sleepy Joe comes in, he's the last guy in the world you expect to do anything radical, right? And they're trying to portray him as a socialist, which nobody believes. I don't even think any...
I feel like they've stopped doing that because they've just given up on that whole thing. He's his polling numbers are, people get a honeymoon when they come into office. But, I mean, his polling numbers are pretty extraordinary right now.
Particularly considering the emergency that we are in. You know, I mean, it's like if you would think that he would, you know, that people would be cynical and expect miracles and whatever, but people seem to be okay. Even more importantly than that, they are very much okay with the policy. I mean, they just came out with polling, you know, this week that showed that the big relief package has a huge majority of people backing it. And that includes some Republicans. And it includes most independents. And there are a lot of independents in this country, by the way. It's a big, big faction. So, you know, and it covers both sides of the ideological divide, you know, however you define that. So, you know, this idea somehow that in terms of economics, that these restrictions that people have been working under, and I don't mean to oversell this because the Republicans are not going to be quiet. They'll figure out a way to kind of go beyond QAnon here, I think, in a period of time. But for the moment, there just isn't an argument. There isn't one that makes any sense. And, you know, in a way, Donald Trump helped with that because he clearly came in and they all love him. And he basically had no economic ideology. It just didn't exist. Whatever was going to help him in the moment, and that was it. So this, you know, other than his trade war, which seems, you know, incredibly irrelevant at the moment. So it's very, very interesting to see that we are in a new place, and I don't want to be, you know, too Pollyanna-ish here and assume that, gosh, everything's going to be terrific, and it's 1934 and Roosevelt's rolling out the WPA or something, but you know, it's better than I thought, and I think so far. And if they can get this thing passed, this reconciliation thing, I think it'll be huge. I mean, I think that will, and I mean on a political as well as
policy level.
Yeah,
you know, I agree with you. I think if they can get this thing passed and it comes out at $1.9 trillion, and you know, I wish they would just go and do the $2,000 checks. I mean, it's just I think, you know, and I'm not terribly happy about this means testing thing that they're doing, and mostly because they're basing it on the 2019 numbers. And the fact of the matter is like, 2020 is very different than 2019 for a lot of people. That's the whole point. And B, if, you know, it's one thing to say like, well, if you made $200,000 in 2019, statistically speaking, you probably have more of a cushion in 2020, even if, you know, something was to go wrong. And again, I don't think that I think they should, you know, if you can't figure out what's going on in 2020, you presume it's bad because it is for a lot of people.
Right.
But if you made $200,000 in 2019, the chances of you being better off than somebody who made $50,000 in 2019 is significantly higher. And so like, that's also what is problematic about dropping, not only having the 2019 benchmark, but dropping those numbers. You start to get, there's without a doubt, I don't know how many people we're talking about. I don't know if we're talking about hundreds of thousands or millions or, you know, way up in the 10,000s of people who are really going to get screwed and desperately need that help. And you're not going to get it because you want to make sure that you're not helping somebody who doesn't need help. That to me is just absurd in this environment. But I'm with you on like, if I had to predict where we would be 12 days out or 14 days out or whatever it is, I would say like, this is pretty good. I mean, I wouldn't have been this positive about, you know, where we're headed. Now, again, it's very early. Things can go south. We've all been there. You brought up Lucy and the football. But I want to talk about this notion of there being, and we've seen this develop over the Trump years, really. And it was certainly headed there. And like, look, you and I have been talking now for 15, 16 years, And I think you and I have been saying for the better part of that, like, hey, this Republican Party is not the Republican Party that the Democrats seem to think they are, or the, you know, sort of the Beltway media, if you will. And you still, like the other day, you know, I saw Chuck Todd say, like, well, I'm sure, you know, a lot of the people in private and in the House don't support Marjorie Taylor Greene. And his own correspondent was like, well, you know, I wouldn't be so sure about that, Chuck. They usually we hear people whisper. Nobody's even whispering. And it turns out, like, you know, half of them gave her a standing ovation when she walked into the Republican caucus room. I mean, so maybe this is getting through some people's heads that, like, hey, wait a second. Our assessment of the Republican Party is has a shelf life, and that shelf life has expired. We have to reassess. But what's fascinating is not just whether the Democrats or the, you know, their corporate media, mainstream media arbiters, essentially, who they look to for their cues about how they should treat the Republican Party. It's not just about what their actions are. I think this idea that you have that it's possible the Republican Party, at least for some period of time, will not even engage in policy is a fascinating one. Because, and I'd like to just sort of explore how that might work a little bit for a moment, because as you're saying it, it's like, it is conceivable, because they now have this parallel media universe, that they don't even have to engage, never mind come up with a counter argument for what the Democrats are doing. They may not even have to engage what the Democrats are doing in terms of the way that the Democrats are voting on legislation or running the government or whatnot, but rather just come up with an entirely different narrative that is focused on, you know, their various moments of aggrievement, certain, you know, fake scandals in the, you know, the Biden administration, overblown, you know, maybe find some things that are like, ooh, that's gross. But it's like that becomes the central narrative that exists, and they can get away with that. And it could be sustaining enough for them within the minority. And they're, you know, for sure, there's 100 laws that are being pushed right now in Republican states to try and foreclose voting for people who will ostensibly be voting against Republicans. But I wonder, like, you know, like I look at like the Fox News and OWN and Newsmax, they're trying desperately to outdo each other. And the story of John Kerry taking a private plane, I think it was, or, you know, talks on climate change, and, you know, somebody got him like, how could you take a private plane? He's like, well, I need to, you know, of course, John Kerry's never been terribly adept at in moments like that. But, you know, the fact is there is COVID, and, you know, the guy's super wealthy, and I'm happy to get rid of all private planes if we're going to do that. But that is like the big story on Fox. And because of that, like they have their whole universe. And it's like, it's almost as if they're willing to say, like, well, fine, let the Democrats do the government-y stuff. We're going to do the, you know, the culture narrative, and that's where we're going to win. And it could, you know, help them win within their sort of like their narrow universe. And they're just going to say, like, we don't really have a policy argument to make. So why should we even play on that territory? Like, fine, let them play the baseball game, but we're going to be out front selling the hot dogs, and we're going to win in the hot dog sales. Like, I mean, it's...
Well, I think you're... To me, that is what's happening. And in a weird way, it's kind of what happened during the... It kind of started to happen during the Trump years. I should say they drew us into that alternate universe because we had to be there, because that's where Trump was, right? I mean, I wrote the other day or a week or so ago about talking about Mitch McConnell. And the fact is that, you know, he didn't really, they don't have an agenda, and they literally didn't have a platform when they ran this last time, in the last election. They just said, you know, whatever Trump wants to do. McConnell, he did two things. And really, that's it. He passed that gigantic tax cut in the Senate, and they tried to repeal Obamacare, and because of the grudge that existed between McCain and Trump, essentially, McCain was the one vote and voted it down. That was it. They didn't do anything else. I mean, they sort of, you know, they would pass these must-pass bills if they had to, you know, the budget and appropriations, what have you. But there was no big debates on policy in the Senate during the 4 years that Trump was in office. And the House was the same way. I mean, you know, I mean, this is before the Democrats took over. This was just not, they just didn't do any legislating, and the reason is they don't have an agenda anymore. They don't have a governing agenda. It's just non-existent. But what they have is this, you know, political maelstrom around culture war. So when you look, for instance, right now what's happening on Fox News, I mean, we know that Trump's about to be impeached, or about to have an impeachment trial. He's already been impeached. And there's this huge issue around whether or not, you know, Donald Trump incited that riot, and whether or not he should be barred from ever holding office again because of it. Now, this is a huge story, and of course it reflects on the entire Republican Party. There were, you know, insurrectionists. You know, these rioters took over the U.S. Capitol during a joint session, which is a rare thing. They hardly ever, you know, have a joint session, while the whole Congress was in attendance, to overturn the election on behalf of Donald Trump. It's gigantic. It's one of the biggest political stories in American history. It happened before our eyes. We all saw what happened. It was huge. Now you have people like AOC, Katie Porter, some others who, you know, were out there kind of talking about their experience and how they were terrified, which I think is totally legitimate because I was terrified just watching it. I can only imagine how they felt. And when we see these people are being indicted, you know, they're talking about how they wanted to blow Nancy Pelosi's brains out. I mean, this was a group of violent, rabid, you know, insurrectionists in the Capitol. So that story, you and I know that's happening. That's the reason for the impeachment trial that's going to happen next week. It's gigantic. On Fox, it doesn't really exist. They're talking about AOC like she's a drama queen. And it's not just Fox. There are other people too,
right,
even some on the left who are making that same argument. But that's what they're trying. They're creating a narrative that this was just kind of a rowdy tailgate party, and it was no big deal. And because AOC wasn't actually dragged out of her office and, you know, beaten or something, she survived it. But somehow it doesn't matter, and it wasn't really that big of a deal. So they're not talking about, you know, and when I thought about this last night, I was thinking about how can they put up this thing about AOC being a drama queen, right, and Katie Porter as well, which Katie Porter certainly is not a particularly, you know, drama queen. And, you know, they put up this, you know, this chyron about those two, ha, 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 mocking both of them, talking about their experience during the insurrection. And I thought, well, how can they believe that? That's just so awful. Well, number one, they'll never show what either of them actually say. They don't have
right.
to. And they've been downplaying the insurrection from the very beginning. And so I don't think their viewers, and their viewers tend to exclusively watch them, Newsmax, and OAN. They won't watch any of the other networks. They probably don't even know the extent of what happened that day, the way that you and I do if we watch MSNBC, CNN, or read anything, you know, any kind of, you know, the testimony from some of these people and, you know, the various things. So they don't actually know what happened. Their viewers don't. So they can create this idea that it was just, you know, things got a little out of hand.
Yep.
And it wasn't that big of a deal, and everybody just needs to chill. And to me, that sort of crystallized for me this idea that they don't, their politics are going to exist on another plane. They
yep.
don't, they're just doing this. This is how they keep their voters excited. And when you think about it, Rupert Murdoch comes out of the tabloid world, right? He's not really a news guy. He started off with tabloid newspapers. They created Fox with a sort of tabloid format. It was a political tabloid format, but that's really what they do. And of course, Fox is in deep, deep trouble. For the first time since 2001, they are the lowest rated news network of all the cable networks. They're being, you know, they've got Newsmax and OAN hot on their tail, and they don't know what to do. They threw everything into the Trump thing. So this is what they're going with. And that is where the, you know, what the dynamic, I think, that we're seeing unfold here, which may, hopefully, if the Democrats continue to kind of go, yeah, you guys do your thing, go ahead, we're just going to carry on here, and they don't get allow themselves to get too enmeshed with what those Republicans are doing, they may be able to get some things done. I mean, I'm not sure what the political fallout of this is for them, because, you know, who knows how many people are being radicalized on Fox News every day, even as we speak, and that's a big problem. But in the meantime, the actual work of government is just being totally abandoned by the Republicans, other than Mitch McConnell doing his usual obstruction and, you know, whatever. But, you know, they do have a minority. So it's very interesting. I just see very little give and take, I guess, between Republicans and Democrats, because they're operating on different planes.
Right. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, right? Because at one point, I mean, at one point, and Democrats can't really get much done is the bottom line, right? They can only do it through reconciliation for the most part. And then, I mean, once this bill is over, there's two other bites at the reconciliation apple, because of the weirdness of the fiscal years, and because reconciliation wasn't used by the Republicans last time because they had nothing to do, really, right? Like, it's only tax cuts. The Democrats are going to get two other big major pieces of legislation. And then the real question is going to be, will they bring up stuff that is about voting rights, let's say, for instance, that can't be done through reconciliation? And will that cause them to get rid of the filibuster? It'll be interesting, because at one point, if our theory that the Republicans can go forward and really not engage in what we have all considered to be politics and governing, you know, and even governing as the opposition party, if they can go forward and find that, like, hey, we don't need to even pretend to engage in that world. In fact, we're better off if we ignore it and just create our own sort of political world that is more sort of like cultural agreements and that type of thing. The question is, like, you know, where are, you know, what's going to happen with, like, corporate forces and chamber of commerce and maybe those forces that are like, hey, wait a second, we don't want them to. You know, we don't want them to pass voting rights, because that could actually change, you know, voting patterns and whatnot. Like, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, because if the Republicans do disengage and the Democrats do end up getting rid of the filibuster, there's things are going to be a little more naked. Right. I mean, you're not going to have recalcitrant Democrats being able to use Republicans as a fig leaf for why things aren't happening. It's going to create certain pressures. Now, things could go a bunch of different ways. And in 3 weeks, the Republicans could manage to be back on, like, we need to be fiscally disciplined, even though nobody even, like, it's nobody could possibly take them seriously on that anymore. I mean, or the concept, I hope. But it's going to be, it has the potential of being very fascinating to see what happens after this. And we should say that there is still some stuff out there that is like, I mean, I think you know this from back your film days. I think it was Hitchcock who said, you know, you put the loaded gun in the drawer at the beginning of the movie, and it creates a tension throughout, right? Like, we all know there's something there. That gun is loaded, and it's in that drawer for some reason. We still have the Trump tax cuts. And the tax cuts that were passed in the first CARES Act, which nobody talked about, for millionaires exclusively, it went to like 45,000 people in the country, worth something like $65 billion a year. Now, this becomes relevant, because if you want to come back with a big reconciliation package to spend money on infrastructure and blah, 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 the question is going to be, where are you going to get that money to offset that from? And that's why we're not seeing them touch the tax cuts right now, because right. I think they're saving those tax cuts to repeal them to balance out future reconciliation bills so that they can do bigger spending there. You know, this COVID relief bill, there's, I think, a broad consensus that it needs to be done. The question is, should it be $600 billion, or should it be $1.9 trillion, et cetera, et cetera? I think you're going to start to see these tax cuts come up in the next iteration. And the real question out of what we see in this reconciliation bill is, what's going to happen with the automatic cuts that may need to come into Medicare? In the past, even during the Trump tax cuts, Democrats, even though the Republicans did that through reconciliation, joined in on a measure to essentially waive that provision and allow the Medicare cuts to not go through. I wonder if Republicans will do the same. That's going to be an issue that we're going to follow, but we will get a better sense of this. And next week, when we reconvene, Heather, we're going to be talking about an impeachment trial that will be underway, and it's going to be fascinating to see how Republicans react in that moment. I think they want this to go away quick because they don't want to be tethered to Donald Trump, but I don't get the sense that Donald Trump has that same plan.
I don't either. And Jamie Raskin, the head of the House Managers, sent a letter asking Donald Trump to testify. So, you know, I doubt he'll do it, but hey, you never know. And that could be very interesting.
You know, he hasn't been on Twitter.
I know.
This might be a good opportunity for him to come in.
Right?
If I was the House, I would say, we'll send a car. We'll send a helicopter. Whatever you need, man. We'll get you here.
Another ride on Air Force One? Here you go.
Here's one more chance.
On.
Relive the glory. In fact, here's a coupon for some golf while you're in town. Heather Digby, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog Hullabaloo. Now I'm going to hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host, Ms. Emma Vigeland. Emma, who do you got today?
Thanks, Sam. Hey, everyone. I am here with Ksenia Chimotina, and she is a senior lecturer at Loughborough University in the UK. You specialize in disaster capitalism and have studied a lot about disaster risk. And so you're a great person to talk about the Build Back Better plan from Joe Biden. So you wrote a piece about this in Current Affairs. Build Back Better for whom? How neoliberalism recreates disaster risks. And you wrote this along with Wesley Cheek. I'd encourage everybody to check out this piece in Current Affairs. It's really well done. How are you doing, Ksenia?
I'm good. Hi, Emma. Thanks a lot for having me tonight.
Oh, of course. I really wanted to touch on this because I did not know that there was a significant history to the phrase build back better. In fact, I thought it was fairly clunky when Biden rolled it out. Can you talk about how that's been used throughout history, including recently by politicians like Justin Trudeau and Boris Johnson in the UK?
Right. So, yeah, I guess building back better is kind of a new phrase for those who are not in disasters or international development. But, you know, we've been sort of tackling with this motto for a while now. So it was originally introduced, or not really introduced, but kind of popularized, I suppose, by Bill Clinton after the Boxing Day tsunami, because he was then kind of leading the reconstruction efforts after the tsunami. And he pronounced this building back better as kind of the best way, you know, to rebuild and to tackle all the inequalities and vulnerabilities and everything that kind of comes with it. And so then the United Nations Body for Disaster Risk Reduction, as it's called now, they sort of, I guess, using this popular face of Bill Clinton, right, took the motto and ran with it. And so now building back better is actually one of the priorities in the Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction, which is the main international framework, you know, that we kind of work under as disaster scholars and disaster practitioners. So for us, for disaster scholars, it has always been a problematic phrase. And so this year, it became kind of a bit of a shock where, first of all the politicians started using the word resilience, you know, kind of here, there, everywhere. And then, of course, over the summer, everybody started using building back better. And so Johnson, the UK prime minister, he came on TV in June, in the end of June, and kind of promised to completely rebuild the country. And he took it literally. So he's promised us to kind of build, build, build. And his key phrase was about building back better, building back greener, and building back faster, because he was trying to boost the infrastructure. And then later in the summer, Justin Trudeau kind of used it as a centerpiece for his talk about COVID and the way that the Canada would go back to normal. And then, of course, Biden used it as his campaign, right? And we were all sort of, we did not expect that, I must admit. So it was, yeah, it was an interesting choice.
Yeah, well, it has a lot of history. So you said the word resilience. You wrote this in your piece. It's a great quote that I actually wrote in my notes. Build Back Better epitomizes the problematic ideology of resilience. And it focuses, you say in your piece, along with Wesley, that it focuses on disasters or frames them as inevitable, when in fact, we saw very starkly in Trump's response to COVID that a lot of the effects of disasters are choices. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, it's not just the effects of the disasters. Disasters are choices as well, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
There is this common phrase of sort of natural disasters that, you know, we have a lot of conversations about, in that when we call disaster natural, we inevitably move the responsibility onto nature, right? And therefore, we're kind of saying, oh, you know, nature wins, I have nothing to do with it. Whereas we know that disaster isn't just about a natural hazard. It's a combination of a natural hazard and the what we would call as condition of vulnerability, basically the root causes of social and, you know, societal systems that have been put in place sometimes centuries ago. So if we think about, for instance, the impacts of Maria, right, on the Caribbean, much of it is due to the colonial legacy and then kind of the imperial legacy. So disasters are really long-winded sort of processes that they just unfold, you know, when vulnerability coincides with a hazard. And so when we talk about disasters, is that kind of we really need to think why we need to take naturalness out of it. And with resilience, it's sort of almost impossible, because resilience sort of frames disasters as inevitable, right? And resilience tells us that it's us who needs to be resilient, and we cannot actually address the root causes, right? So we must adapt instead of changing the situation that we are in and the system that we are in.
Yeah, that came through very clearly in your piece, just about how Biden's approach is just really neoliberalism personified, in the sense that right now it does provide stability. And yes, the technocrats are seemingly excellent reprieves when compared to the chaos, as you write, of the Trump administration, but that they are only reinforcing the very systems that created a lot of this in the first place. I just want to go back a little bit, because you touch on how a lot of this originated post-World War II in international development, which pushed forward globalization, urbanization. You cite Japan and the rebuilding of Germany, which is often in American history textbooks seen as this glorious project. And you know, in some ways, I can understand why it's framed that way, but there were a lot of unintended consequences of this, and putting the United Nations, their creation of the World Bank, the IMF, putting them front and center, and then kind of planting the seed, which sprouted within a few decades later under Thatcher and Reagan, of modern day neoliberalism. Can you give us a historical sense? I know I covered a lot there.
Yeah, it's great. So I just need to add a little bit. Well, it's all that you said, but basically, what happened is that when the institutions like the World Bank, for example, or the IMF were established, the primary role of the World Bank was to focus on international development. And in fact, it was an institute for the international development. But of course, that development needed to be delivered in a way that developed countries, and very much US system in particular, have decided that systems, you know, places need to be delivered. Developed, sorry. And that development was very much grounded, and still is very much grounded in the ideas of growth, which is economic growth, right? And it kind of coupled with GDP. And so what has been happening in Global South, so the post-colonization and kind of fight for independence, wasn't considered. And I'm assuming it was kind of a decision that was consciously made, right? Wasn't considered because that didn't fit in the narrative of development as it was proposed by this new established institutions. And so kind of over the decades that the World Bank is delivering international development, right, and helps everybody develop, this globalized effort, this kind of international effort, it helped to propagate this then new ideology of neoliberalism, right? And just embed it in such a way that it now probably became the most resilient system. And as you know, somebody said that neoliberalism has, it's like a cat, it has seven lives, and we're not to be able to.
Yeah. Well, I actually wanted to just flesh that out for a little bit, because neoliberalism is, you know, it can take on many forms, but I think the primary core of it is that it's deregulating and allowing markets to do what they do and removing government from the marketplace. But, you know, you can see a lot of what was done post-World War II as like a very state-sponsored project, in the sense that the United States and the Allies tried to set things up using their own governmental systems. But how did that get thwarted? How did that get distorted into becoming the neoliberal systems that we're seeing today, that Biden clearly is like a part of? Because setting up those markets, it just seems like it kind of got, distorted in a way.
Yeah, so I guess we kind of need to see neoliberalism not just a sort of managerial project, right? Or, you know, technocratic managerial project, but it's more a kind of project of perhaps, you know, precarity and profit. Because we know that what we want really, and, you know, going back to build back better, and the ideas of disaster risk reduction, the pure ideas of disaster risk reduction and development, is redistribution and equality. But of course, these don't coincide, right? You cannot have equality and profit at the same time. And so neoliberalism, being so malleable and kind of so multifaceted, it's just so easy to use, right? And kind of easy.
That's kind of what I was getting at. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And yeah, you can kind of mold it in a way that you want, right? And really, what it builds upon is your individual ability to do something, the kind of the praise, right, for like, I don't know, American dream, or like being entrepreneurial or something like that.
Bootstraps.
Course, now it's been, kind of been used. And we see it everywhere in disaster context quite significantly.
So another quote from your piece is, the emphasis of Build Back Better is on continuity, i.e. to keep going no matter what. I definitely think Biden even boldly marketed himself as a return to normalcy. A lot of the frustration from progressives like myself is that, well, normalcy is exactly what created Donald Trump in the first place, and there's not very much normal about the conditions that existed before. So can you talk about Build Back Better as continuity in the context of Biden, and also how it was used by these other world leaders and in these other historical contexts that you're referencing?
So I think the kind of the continuity and normality is exactly what you said, right? And Biden, I mean, he has a fantastic platform to do that, right? Because I suppose what was pre-Trump is considered normal. Whereas again, we know that inequality existed, right? Injustice existed. But all of that was just so kind of nicely presented that Biden just builds on that without actually trying to solve the problems, the root causes of the problems. And this sort of going back to normal, you know, in COVID, it really a phrase that sort of triggers me. Because normal, I guess, we almost equate it as good, right? But again, good for who? And who decides what is good? We kind of live in this binary world, right, of choice, where we have to pretend that things are good, right? We almost forced to kind of literally live in a way that one is better than the other, right? Because this is how society wants us. And in some ways, this sort of normal or good categorizes as if you don't want to return back to normal, or if you're not pushing for normal, it means you're pushing for something kind of unintelligible, or perhaps even incomprehensible, right? So normal seen as a desired or desirable state, and in a way that everything that is abnormal is seen as kind of wrong and bad, and of course we don't want to be bad.
Yes, that's exactly how Biden framed his campaign. And it's interesting though that you talked about Boris Johnson at the start obviously, I mean, he's kind of lazily been referred to as the UK's Trump. But he's not that. I mean, yeah. he puts on this blundering facade when he's actually a lot more Machiavellian than Trump, who's I think a lot dumber than Boris Johnson. Not to get too much off on a tangent here, but Boris Johnson represents the right wing of the UK. And yet he is echoing similar language to Joe Biden when talking about infrastructure and a greener infrastructure. I mean, that is shocking in how, at least in language, I mean, also the UK's right-wing party doesn't even, the Tories don't even touch the healthcare system in the UK too. So just, you know, to me, that's a little snapshot of how deeply embedded neoliberalism is in both parties in the United States, and really in both parties in places like the UK too. Although the US is even further right in that kind of amorphous or malleable political spectrum when you look at it internationally. I just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're so to the right now because the center, and so to the right that the center kind of seems left all of a sudden, you know. And you're totally right in that, you know, Johnson is very good in kind of talking the talk, and he's an absolute manifestation of kind of Thatcherism, right? When she was talking that there isn't such thing as society, he absolutely promotes that. You know, it's all about individual responsibility. And, you know, I'm kind of going on with the same sort of thing, but basically what he's saying is that, you know, no matter what austerity measures I put, if you're a good individual, right, you'll survive and you'll kind of suck it up, right, and you'll keep going. And yet, you know, I think you're right in saying that he isn't stupid. These guys who are running the UK, they're extremely well educated, right? They have like the most privileged education. So they left, they read Lenin and Gramsci and Trotsky, you know, and everything else that left is reading and talking about. So they understand the left and therefore are able to kind of undermine, I guess, with their rhetoric and their narrative much better than perhaps left is better, is able to understand the extreme right that we have now. But what he is doing with COVID, and you know, I'm sure you're aware that the response to COVID in the UK has been absolutely atrocious. We're number one now, leading the world finally in you know, in death per capita, which is shocking.
But it's not given the leadership. I mean, given exactly
but it's not
what
given
we're
the
seeing.
Leadership.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
and
right.
so
yeah.
and so yes, while in rhetoric he might be matching Biden, I do think there is a difference. I'm not somebody who likes to promote that false dichotomy, but I don't also want people to be illusioned into thinking, even if Biden is responding as an adult to these crises, that's not necessarily the broader goal. And you write about how a much harder project is restructuring our systems, and this just reinforces systems. And how Build Back Better really represents the opposite of political change. It's technocratic stability. And I wrote that in my notes. I'm not sure if it's an exact quote from your piece or if it's just something I wrote, so I didn't want to misrepresent it. But yeah, I can't tell. My handwriting is terrible. But yeah, I guess I'll just, we can wrap up with that. Even though I think it's a very good temporary stopgap for what was created by Trump or what was, you know, disintegrated by him. How do you see a way to move forward in a much harder structural project when you have somebody who's so status quo, technocratic? I mean, Build Back Better, as you say, this phrase has been recycled for many years now,
right?
By yeah. these exact actors. How do you want to begin undergoing that?
$1 trillion question, I think.
I saved the hardest one for last.
But I think, you know, the first step is to accept that Build Back Better needs to be a political process, because at the moment it is treated as apolitical, right? It's just a continuation of kind of, as we said, you know, going back to normal. Until it is treated or as a non-political matter, right, in a reality that relies on kind of market mechanisms and in a reality that relies on reestablishing the status quo, Biden or any other administration just simply would not be able to even comprehend the structural issues that underpin the process. because I don't think the structural issues are kind of new or invisible, but the rhetoric makes them invisible. And so until we, I guess, accept that, right, and until we denaturalize disasters, you know, including COVID, we will simply be just kind of doing the same thing over and over and over again, because we don't want to take any responsibility for our actions.
I lied. This is the last question. Because I've dabbled in Naomi Klein. Obviously, I'm sure you are deeply, deeply, intimately familiar with her work based on what you've been talking about. But I mean, she talks all the time about how it's, you know, it's industry, it's defense manufacturers, it's, you know, big oil, it's these nefarious, massive corporations and corporate actors who are the ones who take advantage of disaster and who then, you know, push their own agenda forward. And right now, I mean, like, of course, we need a vaccine immediately, but it's also in some ways reinforcing the for-profit healthcare system unintentionally. I mean, I joked about this. If I were president, you know, obviously I would nationalize this effort. But that's not what we're seeing. So I think that's kind of what you're talking about. How do you reframe, truly final question, how do you reframe these issues and these disasters in a way that doesn't just cause people to crawl back into their hole and crave stability, but recognize that next time there's going to be another cataclysmic event and we're going to need structural change?
I think the only way to reframe this is in solidarity and mobilization. You know, we can talk about this and we can write about it. But unless we actually hold government responsible, through solidarity, right, through kind of peaceful action, it will be impossible. We've seen so many examples of this, right? And I think there is now gradually, we can see the movement towards, you know, mutual care and mutual support, because COVID really exposed everything that has been wrong with the society, like in such a deep way that we've probably never seen before, particularly for us, you know, for people living in a safe, I'm kind of thinking, you know, environment.
Right.
And so, yeah, until we kind of mobilize in solidarity, that there is no hope for us.
Oh, well, on that note, no, I mean, there is hope. I do think I am seeing that glimmer as well. But Ksenia Chimutina, she is a senior lecturer at Loughborough University in the UK and wrote this piece, Build Back Better for Whom? How Neoliberalism Recreates Disaster Risks in Current Affairs, alongside Wesley Cheek. Thank you so much, Ksenia, for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much, Emma.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Do us both a favor. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream at 12 noon Eastern every day, or later as a podcast. Emma Vigeland and I cover all the biggest news stories of the day. We do in-depth interviews. Check it out. You'll like it. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.